Hello, welcome to the Foreign Press Podcast. I'm Patricia Vasconcelos. This podcast is an educational program by the Association of Foreign Press Correspondents in the USA, AFPC USA. This episode is produced in partnership with Heinrich Foundation. On today's program, the impact of trade in this U.S. presidential election year. In a recent article, Inu Manak, an expert in international political economy, discussed how U.S. trade policy have returned to reciprocity. To better understand this topic, we invited her to talk to our community of foreign journalists. Inu Manak is our guest today. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Inu Manak is a fellow for trade policy at the Council of Foreign Relations, where she researches and writes on policy issues relevant to U.S. trade policy, including topics such as trade politics and institutions, trade negotiations, and dispute settlement. An expert in international political economy, Dr. Manak's research focuses on U.S. trade policy and the law and politics of the World Trade Organization, WTO. Her recent book, The Development Dimension, is Special and Differential Treatment in Trade with Co-Authored with James Backus, the first chairman of the World Trade Organization's appellate body. Previously, Dr. Manak was a research fellow at the Cato Institute Herbert Stifel Center for Trade Policy Studies and a junior visiting fellow at the Center for Trade and Economic Integration at the Graduate Institute in Geneva. Dr. Manak serves on the advisory boards of the Trade Experts and at the Center on Inclusive Trade and Development at Georgetown Law. She received a PhD in Government from Georgetown University, an MA in International Affairs from American University's School of International Service, and a BA in Political Science from Simon Fraser University. So, again, Inu Manak, thank you so much for joining us today at Foreign Press Podcast.
Thanks, it's great to be here.
So before entering in the details of how the U.S. deal with trade in this electoral year, a question that I believe many colleagues, journalists, or even students of journalism might have: what is the importance of trade in our daily life and why this affects society?
Trade is one of those things that we deal with every day, but often we don't notice that we're engaging in trade. You go to the supermarket, you're probably going to buy something that was not made in the country that you live in. If you get fresh fruit year-round in the United States, probably coming from somewhere else. And so trade touches our lives on a daily basis, whether it be as consumers, as producers as well. Small businesses rely on imports of intermediate products to make things that they then sell to the rest of the world. And then when you think about how we've got through the pandemic through trading services, where folks can get online and sell their services in ways that they never imagined, it kept us connected and kept the economies running. So trade is something that is a fundamental part of human exchange, and it's been around with us forever, as far as we can imagine. And it's something that enriches both individuals and also the country as a whole.
So in a recent article that you published, we are going to talk about this today in this podcast, you argue that trade has become toxic, not just on the campaign trail here in the United States, but in the way that is discussed by both parties. Why is that? Why it has become toxic from your perspective?
Well, I think this turn towards protectionism was a slow simmering change in U.S. politics. So this is something that predates the Trump administration. I would say Trump was more of the symptom than the cause. And in many ways, it comes down to a lot of different factors. And some of it is just an anger against some of the things that happen because of disruptions that occurred, not just because of trade, but also from financial markets. Many people lost their homes during the Great Recession. They struggled to find jobs. And overall, as the US economy has opened over time, there has been a difficulty in adjusting to some of the dislocation that's been caused by trade. And dislocation's a natural part of being open to competition, but the United States in particular failed to adjust to foreign competition in many ways. We don't have a big social safety net like many countries do. We don't really have effective programs for worker adjustment and training. And so there's been a lot of concerns surrounding the ability of the United States to actually adjust to trade disruption and also deal with these other effects in the economy that we felt in the last several decades. So there has been this sense that trade is a cause for this. And that's why a lot of the policies have been targeted at trade as a way to sort of roll back the clock a bit and think about how we can raise barriers instead of opening them.
So you also wrote, in this article that as the United States enters another presidential election year, experts will be at the ready to clarify, debunk, and correct the oversimplifications and flat out falsehoods spewed by candidates on the campaign trail. So without entering in the merit of who said what, could you please give to our listeners some examples of those oversimplifications that the public have been exposed regarding trade?
Certainly. You know, one of the things that we always face during a campaign year is that you're dealing with lots of sound bites, right? So there will be candidates on TV, on Twitter, in different media, talking about an issue. And trade is one of those things that you can't really capture in a couple of words to explain the impact of it. It is unfortunate for us trade experts because we wish it was that simple. But what ends up happening is that you hear a statement and then you have to go out and explain it in more detail. But I would say there are some big persistent blunders that get made that do need to be corrected. So, for example, there have been many times that former President Trump has said that tariffs are paid by foreigners, that the trade war that he launched with China was paid for by the Chinese. But as we know, a tariff is a tax at the border, and the folks that pay the tax are going to be those who import that product. So when you raise barriers to trade, you're actually raising the cost of things that you buy in your own country. Companies take on that cost sometimes, but most of the time they pass it on to consumers. And that's why we see consumer prices rise when there are high tariffs. So this is one of the things that I think is a typical claim that's made on the campaign trail, and one that is unfortunately something we have to explain over and over again.
Well, as a trade expert, a PhD in government as well, what do you suggest for our listeners in order to be more aware what is true or what is not true, how to get knowledge about this?
Well, I think the important thing is to do your own research. You know, on the campaign trail, again, there's going to be so many different issues that are oversimplified. It's not just trade that gets talked about in really simple terms. I think a lot of policy issues are quite complex. So, you know, doing your own research, finding out what's out there, looking to experts in the field and seeing the debates, some of these issues aren't well decided, but informing yourself about what the issues are, what the various opinions are on it, is a good way to figure out for yourself whether the candidates are actually speaking about something that's factually correct or not.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I said here at the beginning, you are a PhD in government, have experience and knowledge to analyze all those topics that we are talking here, and many topics that also world leaders, they discuss in summits and meetings. So from your perspective, is free trade agreement a good deal?
Well, I guess it depends on sort of the content of the trade agreement itself, right? So there's lots of different types of trade agreements that governments enter into. Most of the time, what they try to do is to liberalize trade when they negotiate a trade agreement. That's where the term free trade agreement comes from. Of course, we know that there's no such thing as a free trade agreement in its perfect sense, because there's always some trade that's restricted in the negotiation. Otherwise, a trade agreement would be one page and you just liberalize all trade between the two parties, right? So that would be the perfect example of free trade. So what we really have in many ways is a managed trade system, right? Not just at the multilateral level among many countries, like at the World Trade Organization, where 164 members have rules that they all abide by in the trading system, but then within bilateral agreements or trilateral agreements or plurilateral agreements among many members, there are specific rules that they abide by and certain obligations they take on that liberalize trade to a certain degree. Some trade agreements, like the United States-Canada-Mexico agreement, which is the successor of the NAFTA deal that Trump renegotiated, that one liberalizes about 90% or more of trade between the three parties in goods. So this is one of those examples of where you have a lot of liberalization, but there's still a lot of elements in there that restrict some form of trade. You look at the auto sector, where they have something called rules of origin, where you trace where the product gets made along the supply chain. And for automobiles, a big amount of that auto has to be made within Canada, Mexico, and the United States. So that's a different type of trade restriction that's not a tariff, but still has an impact on the trade relationship between the parties.
So another element that's pretty often common in all, stories that we foreign journalists that we need to mention when we are covering stories regarding to economy and trade is SDT, which means special and differential treatment. Would you mind give an explanation to our listeners? What is SDT and how this apply or not apply to the U.S.?
Yeah, so special and differential treatment is a principle that's deeply embedded in the multilateral trading system. Mm-hmm. So it's part of the WTO. And the idea is that developing countries should be treated slightly differently because of their distinct economic and development needs. So this means that when they sign an agreement, they can have longer phase-in periods to take on new obligations. They could have certain obligations that would be suspended for a time period so that they can build up the capacity, or they can receive technical assistance that would help them meet their obligations. Mm-hmm. Now, at the WTO, there's a clear distinction between least developed countries, which are defined by the United Nations. We know who those countries are. But for developing countries at the WTO, we have an odd system where developing countries declare that they're developing, and that's how you know they're a developing country. So they get special treatment within negotiations because of that. That's created a bit of a problem with some members of the WTO complaining that there are large developing countries that take advantage of these special privileges, like China, when they shouldn't, because they are a very large economy. So developed countries can't take advantage of these privileges, but it has created some concerns that among developing countries, there's a lot of variation in what they can do and the size of their economies, and we should differentiate between them a little better so that we can make sure that the trade rules serve all of their individual needs and not just lump them all together in one big box so that they can't really take the benefits of the obligations that they sign up to.
So taking into account everything that you just explained about developing countries, and I'm thinking here how developed countries deal with that. In that article we are talking about that you recently published, you argue that the US approach to trade cannot even be called like that, the US approach to trade. And why is that?
Well, I would say if you were to look at US trade policy under the Biden administration, not a lot has been done on the trade agenda in the last several years. You look at their signature trade agreement, the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, that has four pillars. Only three were concluded last year. The one pillar that was missing was the trade pillar. So it's very hard to conceive of this being a trade agreement when the trade pillar is not even finished. So I think if that's their signature deal and they don't have a trade component, it's very difficult to say that they have a very clear approach to trade policy that they developed with negotiating new deals. They have other attempts they've made in the Americas. There's something called the Americas Partnership for Economic Prosperity. That also just got off the ground in November and still is in its early stages, hasn't really developed. So we haven't seen much movement there. Mm-hmm. And in terms of negotiating any new trade deals, there haven't been any. So we really have not been out there trying to negotiate new agreements or even improve old ones. At the World Trade Organization, the United States has not really advanced a lot of the priorities that have been negotiated for many years, that negotiations have been ongoing, such as on the e-commerce deal that is still underway. And hopefully when the ministers meet in Abu Dhabi, it's coming up pretty soon, that they will be able to... Mm-hmm. End of February. That's right. They'll be meeting in 2 weeks' time, I suppose, to try to figure out the outcome of that deal. But even there, the United States in November pulled back some provisions that for a long time it had supported. And so there is some consternation of whether there is support for getting any of the deal over the finish line. So I think largely when you talk to our trading partners, they're not quite sure what to make of US trade policy because we're not doing any of the things we used to do in trade at all.
It could sound like a basic question, but why is like that and how to fix it if needs to be fixed it or to turn in another direction?
Yeah, I mean, it's maybe the million-dollar question. Why is it like this, right? I think part of it, if you want to explain why this is happening during the current administration, mm-hmm. I think they were left with a very complicated trade policy from the Trump years. Trump had renegotiated the NAFTA, and you have the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, and you've seen that the Biden administration has been using one enforcement tool quite a bit under that agreement to tackle concerns about labor in Mexico. So they've been using enforcement tools, but they haven't really been expanding trade even further in the region. If you look at other things that they inherited from Trump, they were pretty contentious. You're thinking about the China tariffs, Section 301, the big trade war with China, billions of dollars worth of tariffs there. There were tariffs put on steel and aluminum, mostly on our allies that were kept in place. And I think one of the challenges is that when Biden came into office, trade really wasn't a priority for him. He had a lot of stuff on the Build Back Better domestic agenda. That's where he wanted to focus. And most of the time, what you would see for a president is the second half of his term, he would shift or she would shift to some sort of more foreign policy orientation and dealing with other issues such as trade. We didn't see that happen. I think part of it is this fear that if you talk about trade, then you're going to empower Trump to come back again, who ran in his first term on a really anti-trade message. And I think that really got him a lot of votes in areas where the Democratic Party typically held a majority, but they lost it when Trump went against Hillary Clinton. So I think there is this fear that if you're pro-trade in any way, that will somehow hurt you electorally in November.
Mm-hmm. From a technical perspective, is that I know it's not an easy answer, but from a technical perspective, is that a way that developed countries like the US, that they could adjust to foreign competition if they would like to?
Certainly. I think there's a lot we can do in the United States that could put workers here on better footing. I think one of the challenges is that we've had trade programs, such as it's called trade adjustment assistance, that haven't really worked. And part of the problem with that is that we focus so much on trade as the disruptor, when there are a lot of different reasons you can have disruption in the economy. Automation is one of them. Robots take jobs a lot more than trade does. We have lots of machines that assemble vehicles and do the checkout at the grocery store. There's so many times that we are in touch with automation as a part of our new economy. So thinking about how we can deal with general disruption, economic disruption in the entire economy would be probably a good place to start. That means some of the things we could do: better worker training, retraining programs, so when folks do lose their job because of anything, not just trade, they can get the training they need to do something else. Also making it easier for people to move around in the country when they need to find another job, and also improving sort of vocational training for people outside of high school through college, giving them options to do apprenticeship programs and things where they can develop hard skills. So I think there's a lot that we could experiment with and try and actually learn from a lot of other countries that have already implemented these policies and make our bottom line a lot better and give more opportunities to Americans.
And we have seen, regardless who is in power, decisions that are related to trade that are based or affected by security issues. We have at least two big wars happening in the world now. Is there a way to avoid this, to avoid that decisions based by security issues, that they might be so important in decisions regarding trade?
I think that if you look at the long history of trade, security has always featured as one of the things that drive some trade decisions. The unique thing that we've seen since the Trump years has been security coming to the forefront of those discussions. So a lot of things are described as necessary for economic security. This is why Trump applied the steel and aluminum tariff, saying that it was essential for U.S. economic security. Now, others cannot maybe look at the data and see that it seems kind of odd that we would have a national security threat from getting steel and aluminum from Canada or from Europe. These are our NATO allies. But again, it's just the way that these issues are being talked about and discussed that you can pretty much frame almost everything as a national security threat and use it to protect certain industries that are not competitive. Now, on the other hand, there are some issues that are unique national security issues that we do need to deal with. There can be disruptions caused by different supply chain issues. There can be over-reliance on a particular country for certain goods, which you may not want to have just one country that you rely on for something. You want to diversify your supply chains. These are legitimate security concerns that we should be considering. But again, security is always part of the balance of decisions, but it should not ever be the main reason you're making some of these key decisions.
And what comes next? More trade restrictions, an open market? What is statistics shows?
Well, I think if we're looking at the trends in the last several years, I would expect that regardless of who wins the election in November in the United States, we're likely to see more of the same on trade. So I think if we see President Trump come to power again, we probably have more trade restrictions. He's talked about it already quite a bit, putting a really hefty tariff on the entire world. I don't think President Biden would do anything similar to that, but certainly he would maintain the trade restrictions he's already kept in place.
And to finalize, any tip, anything you would like to add to our audience, mainly for journalists that they are listening to us, anything that they might pay attention during this year in order, to develop a story, an interesting perspective, something that from a journalistic point of view, we maybe might be aware.
Yeah, I think one of the most interesting things that I often come across, if you look at the way that politicians talk about trade versus how people think about trade, I'm talking about average Americans and just citizens in the country, They're finding much more positive about trade. Overall, most Americans don't support blanket trade restrictions. Most of them see the benefit of trade to their everyday lives. And yet the rhetoric on the campaign trail often does not mirror that. And I think that's one of those interesting things that we should dig into a little bit further in kind of understanding a little bit why the sentiment of trade being so negative has taken over some of the campaign rhetoric, but we don't see it necessarily all the time when we ask people the questions about whether or not they support trade. So I think part of it is talking to people, asking them about how trade affects their lives, hearing stories from everyday Americans about their experience and their relationship with the global economy. And I think in many ways that brings us to a more factual basis for talking about these ideas and talking about the impact of trade rather than looking at some of the high-level talking points that we see not just from our politicians, but many others.
Well, Inumana, thank you so much for talking to us and being part of this Foreign Press podcast. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I spoke today with Inumana, PhD in government and an expert in international political economy. This episode is produced in partnership with Heinrich Foundation. See you next time.